So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review me.
There's Hogan.
Here's the moment right here.
Dropping the leg on Ric Flair. Waking up Mr. T for the one, two, three. The career of Ric Flair's over. It's over.
That's the one thing that I'm going to regret because we said it before the match. I'm going to say it now. Like him or not, I tremendously respect Ric Flair and what a loss he is going to be to this great sport.
Yeah, he really is. And fans, we will have an update on exactly what happened, why this butcher of a brother turned on Hulk Hogan the way he did, and why this big avalanche of a man came in to attack Hulk Hogan. It was a tremendous night. Our thanks to everyone involved in World Championship Wrestling for Halloween Havoc.
Ric Flair.
Quit your crying, you big bull baby. Look at you.
All of
Ric Flair, thank you. Thank you for 20-some years of the greatest.
And I would agree.
Happy Halloween, Havoc, from John Pollock and Wei Ting. It's our Halloween special, Mr. Ting. What are you wearing? Tell us where this mask is from and why it's got four horns coming out of multiple sides of your head.
Well, these aren't
a psychosis tribute?
No, these aren't horns. These are actually locks of hair.
And you've gelled them.
Yeah, I'm dressed up as Son Goku.
Son Goku? Oh, yeah. Is that like a... makes me think of a Gouken Saki. Different.
Oh, similar.
Tell who is Son Goku?
Son Goku is the chosen one. The legendary Super Saiyan.
Oh.
From the planet formerly known as Vegeta.
I'm dressed up as a Magikarp. I am a White Plains.
What? What?
I'm,
oh, okay.
I am...
That's why you're so...
Pale? And just look off into the distance?
Yeah, and thin. That's why you're looking so
thin. You can't get much with one plane.
Okay.
Now, if I was a mountain or a forest, you could launch a lightning bolt.
Did you see that?
A giant growth, but you'd need a creature first.
So how much are you worth in today's market?
Cents. Pennies.
Okay.
You should. Lands are nothing. Lands are just like, you know, it's like gas to put in the car. You can't do anything without gas. You need lands.
Why didn't you pick a more rare card? Like the, what the fuck was that?
I want to appeal to as many Magic followers as possible. I could be an icy manipulator.
Did you see the unboxing video where the guy finds this ultra rare card that's worth like...
I didn't watch the video, but I saw the posting from one of our listeners. The Black Lotus.
Black Lotus, yes.
Which was the card. And it's worth, what, $30,000?
Something like that.
Like, that card was like the jackpot of cards when I played, and it was nowhere near $30,000 worth.
The jackpot of cards. Like, what? Like, I'm trying to still try to understand. Like, what would you say that would
be? It's a combination of how rare it is, what its actual abilities are in a game.
Huh.
And that's how the worth of these cards would be deciphered.
Okay.
Like a Jester's Cap at the time. That was a card that was... It was a real sought-after card, but it wasn't super rare. And at that time, I mean, one piece of cardboard being worth $30 to me, you might as well have told me that thing was worth $1,000. $30 for a card seemed crazy. So when I finally got a Jester's Cap, boy, was I excited. It was the card, because it was within grasp of my friends. Like, someone could get a $30 card. It's conceivable.
And how, like, I mean... Who determines the rarity of these cards?
There used to be a trading magazine called InQuest, I believe. And that used to be the trader's guide.
And it just depends on how many of these get made?
That was one of the things. Like, I mean, it's no different really than, you know, a baseball card. If there's a really rare rookie card of some now superstar player, certainly it's going to go up in value. But it's also how many... are out there. If but it's someone's autograph, someone who never does autograph signings, yeah. his autograph's going to be worth a lot more than the guy that's at every single weekend convention. And
but these are unique because, I mean, there's no Black Lotus in real life, you know? There's no statistics for Black Lotus to... Like, a Black Lotus can't increase his stats in real life to make his card and his memorabilia more valuable. This is just like... These people made this card and determined that this is going to be this powerful. And
well, think about it. If you have a card that could be a major difference maker,
I know.
If you are a competitive Magic card player, this is something you want in your arsenal.
Absolutely. I'm just saying that.
You win this, money from this.
This is all, but these are all things that the creators themselves have decided. You know what I mean?
Like, well,
tomorrow they could make a card that is just like, it'll just like. It'll make you make the person playing have to strip, for instance. This magic card says, oh, if you put this card down, your opponent has to strip naked.
Well, they did have a card called the Strip Mine, where you could strip his deck.
Okay, whatever. But anyway, they can only make two of these cards in existence. All of a sudden, that's just like printing money. You know what I mean?
To a degree, but the market will also price it out. I mean, if there's no demand... The supply will be...
There will definitely be a demand for a card like that.
Where you would have to strip naked?
Or whatever, yeah.
Well, that kind of is going outside of the realm of a game. I mean, a guy being fully clothed or not in a game of Magic cards really doesn't affect his lifeline.
It's just memorable. It's just embarrassing. Like, it's psychological damage.
I guess so. That's a different level of Magic playing. Clearly a game you should stay away from.
Yeah, I don't know.
Richard Garfield would not approve of you.
I mean, at this point, after however many years this game has been in existence, I think people have already developed such deep tactics that I think it'd be hard to jump into it.
I feel it's making a bit of a comeback just from people around me. Maybe it's the Josh Barnett effect, but man, I have family members that are playing and my cousin is super into it. I'm wondering if this is indicative of a larger outpouring of interest Magic the Gathering.
I mean, I think just geek culture in general is sort of a... I mean, it has been for a long time now, over the past several years, hitting the mainstream. But I think, like, card games, board games especially, have been, you know, gotten really popular over the past several, years.
I got into Magic cards because of the complete... the opposite... the benefits of peer pressure. My friends got into it, and I felt like such an outcast because I'd watch them, and it was like, man, I have no clue how to play this game, but it's all they play during recess. Yeah. So it was, you know, fight or flight. You either learn how to play Magic cards or you're a loner at school, and you'd have to go off and play at the basketball net by yourself.
It was either join a gang or play Magic cards.
That was it. That was a big decision I had to make at the age of 12.
Yeah.
Wow. And I fought. Well, and I dove headfirst into this thing. I had an insane obsession.
You succumbed to a life of...
Magic. That's where I go in spurts with things that I will have an obsession about and just dive right into it.
Oh, me too. Absolutely. So are you back to playing Magic?
No. I haven't made the full transition back.
Why not, man?
I've got to dig up my old cards. I know that they exist.
You could just build a new life.
See, I have no clue about the current, you know... libraries that are out there, the new cards people are playing with. I still maintain I could do fine with my deck from circa 98.
Oh, your old school.
Oh, my red green deck, bro. You don't have a chance.
You'd be like a 90s NBA player thinking that you could hang with the new crop of kids.
I'd be like Ricky Steamboat coming back in 2009 and blowing away 3/4 of the roster working with Chris Jericho.
You could be, or you could be someone completely out of their element.
Who's someone that's made a noticeably bad comeback?
Bret Hart.
WrestleMania was not the greatest.
Yeah.
In 2010.
Although, like, I mean, that's sort of an unfair comparison.
Yeah.
Because I don't think Bret. I don't think Bret really won. He probably knew.
How would you assess, maybe a better comparison? How about Batista coming back?
I think he could still hang, you know? I mean, at least, like, you know, his promo, oh, whatever. This run wasn't good, but I wouldn't say that was necessarily all
his. I think
his
there
fault.
Were more extenuating circumstances yeah. that hurt Batista yeah. rather than Batista himself.
I think he still has the physical ability. I think his character is still there. His promo ability is probably still there.
He's also gone off and is so much of a bigger star outside of WWE than in it.
Yeah.
And I would argue that I've done so much more after Magic Cards that I'm bigger than the world of Magic at this point. I mean, me coming back, oh, yeah. that would be a hell of a coup for a local Toronto vendor to get me in a tournament.
The Magic community wants you, John. They want the return of John Pollock.
Yeah, if you want to bring me back to the Ice Age Alliance days, I'll give you some visions.
I don't even know what that means.
It's all a mirage, Wei. These are all different. All different card variations.
I wish I could appreciate your jokes, but I can't.
Well, Wei, maybe I should just retire from Magic Cards forever.
Don't they have like a WWE version? Like, didn't they ever make like a WWE playing card game? I guess this phone game.
Definitely did.
And this phone game they have is sort of like that.
Yeah. They've got their app game now. There definitely was this card game, because my buddy Ziggy bought all the cards and stuff, and it just seemed like the most confusing game possible. I never got into it, but there was.
And you just like take turns, like, and with the guy's moves.
Yeah, I mean it's not really that far different from Magic Cards, where instead of creatures, you have wrestlers that are going to.
So what would be the Black Lotus of the WWE card game?
Oh boy, it would the Black Lotus. Like, I mean, it would have to be Bruno Sammartino, wouldn't it? Circa 64.
He's the Black Lotus?
The mid to late 60s.
He's the ultra rare card that'll.
The guy held the title.
That'll defeat everybody?
He would. I mean, if we're just looking at.
Stats, I guess.
Stats would be key. I mean, Hogan. How many losses did that guy have in the 80s? There was the disputed finish against
Andre. So I guess
Andre.
You'd have an 80s Hogan card.
Yeah, you would have to break it up into. Generations,
characters.
I would say.
I mean,
Hulk Hogan circa 2000. Come on.
Right. Oh, interesting.
Not as high a power level.
Hmm.
Maybe politicking you could have as a...
I would say like the Undertaker card probably. Like the... I guess like the
it would depend. 2000s. Undertaker, WrestleMania Undertaker, but Royal Rumble Undertaker, where he always had to sell to set up the WrestleMania program, not as Invincible.
Right. Yeah, I don't think
you should really sit down and come up with this.
I'm not going to do that.
And then we'll chat about it on the show.
No.
You know what also is coming out this week is the WrestleMania. No, not WrestleMania. The WWE video game, 2K15.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Have you heard about this NXT mode?
Yes. In fact, our pal Shane, he was telling us that if we ever want to review the game, we've got to have him on. Because he's going to be playing this thing nonstop once he gets it on whatever it is, Tuesday morning, yesterday morning.
I would love to, but I mean, I have to be prepared to lose like 2 weeks of my life. Because that's how...
We might be getting a review copy of it.
Yeah.
We're pushing to get some review copies.
Yeah, it'll just take up so much of my time because I'll have to beat and unlock everything. But I'd like to play it. To be honest, it doesn't seem that all that different from previous years. It's just a different roster, you know.
Well, Shane was explaining, because I don't know much about this game, but Shane was explaining to me the NXT mode, it starts like day one where you're trained under Bill DeMotte.
Oh, really?
And you can go through your entire career, right through like to the Hall of Fame. And it sounds intriguing. Like, if I was...
But I mean, what exactly is the difference? Like, I guess they'll teach you... Bill DeMotte will teach you how to hit A button, you know, or B button combinations. But then you just, like...
Well, you got to win matches.
Okay, you win matches. But the game's still...
I've said it before. A legit pro wrestling RPG would be so fun.
I think that exists. Maybe not an RPG, but like
I mean everything about pro wrestling, like where you have the newsletters that are going to critique your performances, where you get a certain amount of money and you can enhance your look by whatever means, where you have to pass tests. I would take a month off work to play it.
I'm sure you would love that. I'm sure maybe a portion of our audience would love it. The vast majority of people that play video games would find that so boring.
I disagree. If you were into like Grand Theft Auto, you make the Grand Theft Auto of WWE, where it's like all this shit you're doing.
Grand Theft Auto, you get to steal cars. What are you doing?
You could steal cars as a wrestler.
Why would you do that?
You need to get to the next town. We used to have territory mode.
You'd be yeah. The mode would be trying to book hotels and driving, following a GPS.
You can take out some of the minutia. Or but there's like a lot of cool stuff you could do.
I feel like the life of a wrestler is not really as glamorous as maybe we picture.
Well, you cherry pick. You take out the outstanding aspects.
Okay. Anyway, so are you going to play this game?
If we get a copy of it, I'm not going out to buy this game. I don't even have a system to play it on.
What do you think about the NXT roster that they chose? You got Sami Zayn. You have, I guess, Rusev and Bo Dallas, who they consider NXT guys. And then who's the other guy?
I have no clue.
It's people are screaming it into the thing. But no, I was just curious what you think about the few select people that they chose and what it means for those people, because obviously...
Oh, it's great for them because, talent still gets a cut of video game sales, and last year's video game didn't do all that well, and it really reflected in people and their payoff. So for a young guy like Sami Zayn, he's going to make a ton if this video game is successful.
It's
so
incredible.
Good for him.
It's incredible that he just all of a sudden got this, like, he's in a video game now, you know? Like, and he hasn't even made his official debut on the roster.
Which tells you that, I mean, they clearly look at him as one of the key guys in NXT. And second, the fact that they're including someone like that tells me that they believe a good segment of their video game buying audience would be familiar with who a Sami Zayn
Absolutely.
Is and catering to that.
And I kind of, I attribute that idea probably more to 2K and than the WWE themselves, you know, because I mean they're the ones we know who got the Warrior thing going on. They got the Sting happening stuff. By the way, the full roster is Sami Zayn, Andrea Neville, Rusev, Corey Graves, and Bo Dallas.
Well, Corey Graves finds himself in there. He's got some serious concussion issues that might prevent this guy from ever really getting anywhere. He's been out a long time.
So I wonder why they chose him.
I'm sure this was decided way, way back at that point, where Corey Graves was someone they were positioning very well in NXT, right. And injuries have completely derailed him.
I look forward to, though, if they continue this for next season, if because then you could throw in a lot of guys like Kenta and Steen, and I wonder if those people would even be add-ons that they'd consider.
Yeah, well, you would have Hideo Itami, Finn Balor, and I wonder what Kevin Steen's name will be.
Somebody suggested Tim Horton, which I think would be so fun.
I saw that, and I thought, oh, my God, have they announced this? And I totally bought that they were going to name him Tim or Tom Horton.
Yeah.
It's totally believable.
Tom Hurton.
There used to be an indie wrestler in Ontario named Tim Hurton.
Tim Hurton?
Which is a great gimmick name if you're in the indies. When you're in the WWE or TNA, death. Yeah. Very different.
No, they wouldn't.
And I'm very much not on the camp of just freaking out over guys' names. I think so many people get upset over new ring music or a new name. And I just think, like, to me, I've seen some of the most horrendous names given to guys, and it's meant nothing to their long-term success.
Yeah.
Triple H is my go-to. Mm-hmm. Dolph Ziggler. Has that name really hurt this guy?
That one I actually do think it has.
You think that's really hurt him?
There are a lot of things
maybe
that
to
have
non-fans
hurt him.
That have never... If this guy were to be introduced on Conan O'Brien, Dolph Ziggler, of course you're going to get giggles. You're right. But to wrestling fans, I don't think the name has hurt him at all, and it's a horrible name.
I feel like it's probably a name that really on the list of things that I've heard him, that's probably on the near the bottom. But I feel like a name like Dolph is just it. I don't know. I feel like he could have had a cooler sounding name, maybe a more chantable name.
Dolphy, the Dolphans. Didn't quite
anyway.
Work. Well. If we get this video game, me and Wei will definitely try it out. And I encourage anyone that does play the video game, now that it's out this week, leave some of your comments on the message board. I want to hear feedback from folks out there that are playing 2K15. That crew at 2K, they are very in tune with the independent scene as well. A lot of times I've heard from guys on the indie scene, not affiliated with WWE, who have been brought in to do motion capturing, and that's apparently a hell of a payday if you get that gig. Come in, get hooked up to the crazy suit,
mm-hmm.
just do guys' spots in the ring. And typically you find guys on the indies that are major fans. They know all the guys' spots. They're easy to work with, and they get a nice payday out of it. So it's mm-hmm. a trickle-down effect, the video game,
yep.
for the wrestlers. Halloween Havoc, 1994 is our review this week. Ric Flair's final match, a memorable event, and one that I only found out this past weekend that Dan the Mouth Lavransky attended back in October of 1994.
Wow.
So we'll hear from Mr. Lavransky a little later on about what compelled him and his buddies to get into a car and drive to Detroit to watch Halloween Havoc in 1994. This was all built around career versus career. Who would retire? Hulk Hogan, the man they had just spent millions on and brought in, and this was his second pay-per-view, and who they were building the company around, or Ric Flair? Who would lose this match? And as much as we can laugh about it today, at this point in time, Ric Flair was adamant that if they go ahead with this match, then that's it. I'm not going to be one of those guys that just hangs around and violates stipulations.
Had he not had any retirement matches before?
He had done retirement stipulation matches, but not lost a retirement match.
Oh, okay.
Up until this point.
All right.
So that would be our big main event, which everything would be based around on this show. And the idea here was that they had come in. Hogan's first pay-per-view was the last time at Bash at the Beach earlier that summer, and they wanted a big show because the way things were structured was they had spent a lot of money in 94, and they wanted to have this big pay-per-view to try and make up for some of the losses in 94 with this last pay-per-view that they could get on the books for 94, because obviously Starrcade would trickle into 95, and you had to save a main event with Ed Leslie for the next year.
Yes.
Which that show would be headlined by. A lot of Ed Leslie on this show.
Yeah.
Let's just flat out say, when it comes to major league promotions, is there a worse main eventer in history than Ed Leslie? Because he was positioned as the number one or number two heel coming out of this show. I've never seen a man get so far with so little than Ed Leslie.
He's certainly on the level of terrible main eventers. They at least... they at least had something. You know, it was Hogan. If it was like Ed Leslie versus like Virgil, I think that would have been worse.
That would be worse.
Yeah.
Well, that would be our big reveal later in the night. Our announcers tonight are Tony Schiavone, a recovering from neck surgery Bobby Heenan, and Mean Gene Okerlund. And they showed Muhammad Ali sitting in the front row. This was a deal they had made with the Muhammad Ali Foundation. So we had such notables as Ali, Thomas Hitman Hearns. Somewhere in all of this, though never shown on camera, was Hank Aaron. So a bunch of notables here in the crowd. I was amazed that these guys sat and watched a three-hour pay-per-view.
No, me too, actually.
I would imagine, boy, bring me up for the main event. I'm not sitting through the Honky Tonk Man and Johnny B. Bad.
And they were sitting right, like, camera side, ringside, too.
Oh, yeah, they couldn't get up and disappear.
They couldn't look bored, can't yawn, you know? You got to look good.
Heenan, I thought, you know, so many times we look at Bobby Heenan's WWF run as compared to WCW as a broadcaster. I thought he was one of the highlights of the show here. This was a motivated Bobby Heenan completely backing Ric Flair and how important this match was. Before the main event even began, this was the greatest pay-per-view Bobby Heenan has ever seen, he said, which I have a feeling was exactly what he said about another pay-per-view we recently reviewed. They just keep topping themselves in WCW, according to Bobby Heenan.
He just anticipates a really great review. I agree. I thought he was hilarious on this show, just to hear him, especially, you know, to have somebody he's attached to, like Flair, be the top heel in the company at the time, and then the main event of this show, just to kind of hear how, like, he basically treated Ric Flair like a god throughout this entire broadcast, and it was just really fun hearing him exaggerate so many things.
He gave a history lesson at the beginning of the show about wrestling in Detroit, bringing up the Sheik, Bobo Brazil, the Dick the Bruiser Alex Karras match, and how tonight the city will host Hulk Hogan's final match. The stakes were high.
Mm-hmm.
Then they plug the hotline and explain why Sting isn't on the show. And then we got a national anthem sung by T. Graham Brown, apparently a notable singer, wearing the most hideous of hideous shirts. He was wearing this button-up that was like a checkered flag, as if all the cars in the race had run it over. I think it had like dirt all over it. It looked, this shirt.
No, I mean, it was not in the 90s, you know?
Whew. T. Graham Brown. The highlight of this anthem was cutting to this Hulk Hogan lookalike in the crowd, standing at a 90-degree angle, saluting a fan's flag.
Yeah, I saw that guy. I've seen that guy at a number of shows.
Oh, he's the Hulk Hogan guy that traveled to all the cities.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't do so as much. And they had the whole Halloween Havoc setup at the front. I always liked the goofy WCW sets because they were at least different. It themed the pay-per-view, as campy as they looked. But one of the tombstones read Crockett on it, which was rather nice. Amusing. I was trying throughout the night to see other tombstones, but they weren't lit very well. Johnny B. Bad and the Honky Tonk Man kicked off tonight's festivities for the television title.
Two music gimmicks. You had the Elvis impersonator and the Little Richard impersonator.
What a battle.
Yeah.
Johnny B. Badd comes out with fangs in his mouth, and Tony Schiavone, before the match even starts, instantly notes it's a 10-minute time limit.
Mm-hmm.
There was no drama to what was happening in this particular match. I mean, they hit you over the head about this 10-minute time limit. They gave us warnings, 5 minutes gone by, 3 minutes remaining in the match.
Is that the only stipulation about the TV title? It's only 10 minutes?
No, in fact, that wasn't a regular stipulation for the television title. But unfortunately, old Honky Tonk Man didn't feel the need to put over one Johnny B. Badd, and this would be it for the Honky Tonk Man in WCW. They also noted that Johnny B. Badd has a new move, the Bad Day. Will we get to see the Bad Day? And Schiavone also asked, as Johnny B. Badd brought out his Bad Blaster. Who's going to get the Bad Blaster? God, man. I can appreciate puns, but Johnny B. Badd, like everything about this guy, had to somehow incorporate bad.
Yeah.
The Bad Blaster, as he shot confetti out of this gun to the fans.
I'm bad.
There was a back elbow that sent Johnny B. Badd down called the Double Hitchhike, which I think was the dance move Honky Tonk Man would do. They called the Double Hitchhike. I have no clue. Honky Tonk Man goes for the shake, rattle, and roll, but Bad suplexes him over. They're going over all the time gone by. The best of all the lines. Johnny B. Badd has this punch called the kiss that don't miss, which he missed.
Yeah.
They brawl around the ring. And the time limit expires as Johnny B. Badd goes for the small package. The announcers want 5 more minutes. I did not. And then Badd no-sells an atomic drop, and HTM, Honky Tonk Man, bails to the floor, taking a powder, as Schiavone noted. And we go to a draw.
Hey, I don't mind the time limits all that much, you know? If you're going to do a... I prefer draws over another bullshit distraction finish. In fact, I think they should bring back a lot of draws for TV. You know, often you want to pair up two guys, but you don't want to have one go over the other. Then just give me a draw. I'd rather have that and save up for the ultimate eventual finish at a later date.
Well, the issue here, though, was they wanted Johnny B. Badd to win. Honky Tonk Man said no, and he left the company then after this. He wasn't coming into WCW to do jobs. Discredit the good name of Wayne Ferris. They recapped the Clash of Champions card in August, which featured the Nancy Kerrigan angle that they just blatantly took from, with Arn Anderson under a hood attacking Hulk Hogan and injuring his knee. This was great because we got a fan sign, a good old acrostic poem for Hulk, standing for humanity, understanding, living. The man epitomizes living. And kindness. This is awesome. Why wasn't this a t-shirt?
Humanity, understanding, living, kindness.
Is that the best you could come up with? Living. Just stuck on that word L.
I thought it said loving. Was it living? Or either one is hilarious.
Either one would be great.
Oh, God.
Then this led to two masked men revealed on October the 9th. attacking Hogan. So we had two mysteries to solve. And then they cut to what was identified on the screen as amateur video, where Ric Flair approached Mr. T outside of Michael Jordan's restaurant and led to the idea that Ric Flair has bought off Mr. T, who will be the special referee in tonight's main event.
Okay.
Amateur video. They were way ahead of the curve here. This would be TMZ 20 years later.
Cell phone.
You could argue that TMZ sometimes, it appears they're working with some promotions with some of these amateur videos that appear.
Sure,
Triple H haircut, exclusive.
Yeah. Sure, all those sites. I mean, Perez Hilton, I'm sure they all have deals.
Tag title match was next. Two great tag names. Stars and Stripes, consisting of Buff Bagwell, Marcus Alexander Bagwell at the time, and The Patriot, taking on Paul Roma and Paul Orndorff. Pretty wonderful. Orndorff, early in this match, achieved side control, but then Patriot swept him into the mount.
Incredible. They must have been watching their Gracie in action videos.
They probably had just watched UFC 2 and were just implementing their ground games.
They're training in their gis.
Roma, first of all, who had the most jacked body of these four?
I was going to say, I mean, a number of Putski candidates in this match alone.
I could put all four on the list.
Yeah, but
Roma may be a step above.
Roma and the Patriot in particular. And I don't know. I'd say I give the edge to Paul Roma slightly over the Patriot.
Paul Roma was quite the specimen. There was this awkward spot where Orndorff.
Have you noticed how much he looks like Ken Shamrock?
Yes, in the face completely.
Yeah. Well, and the body here too.
Well, yeah, the body. If he were to had cut his hair short, he would have been a dead ringer for Ken Shamrock.
And thus the jiu-jitsu.
I guess so. Yeah, he's they should have had Stars and Stripes and Geese against Ken Shamrock and
Stripes like on belts.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
Belts and Stripes.
Orndorff runs into Bagwell, and Bagwell, clearly there was a miscommunication here, and he just pauses and then scoop slams Orndorff, and then Schiavone and Heenan applaud Bagwell for his improvisational skills. Way to think when your spot gets messed up, essentially, is what they're saying. Wouldn't a legitimate pro wrestling match all be improvisational? At least the vast majority of it?
Sure, yeah. Well, I don't
know. Like if I was going to mount you in a jiu-jitsu match and I didn't get the knee on belly and you blocked it, but then I was able to recover and then change into an armbar perhaps, would that be great improvisation on my part? Oh,
yeah.
No, they blew the spot.
Right, right. It's all improv, but maybe Schiavone just felt like this was in particular really good improv.
They got the heat on Bagwell for quite a long time. Bagwell eventually applied a sleeper. Roma came in to break it. All four are fighting in the ring. Then Bagwell hits what apparently was one of his key moves, the bridge suplex. Delivered that to Orndorff, but Roma comes off with an elbow drop, and I put that in quotation marks. This is where Taryn Terrell learned how to hit an elbow drop, because Roma just lands straight down on his tailbone.
Oh, right.
The most awkward landing. And it's the exact same way Taryn Terrell. The first time I saw her do it, I just thought she messed it up. But this is the way she always does it. And it's the way Roma did it here. This looks so goddamn painful.
I didn't notice so much when Roma did it here. But like with Terrell, it's, you know, I assume that she wants a move with higher impact.
Well, her spine is saying, Taryn, land on your side, for Christ's sake. And this is all behind the referee's back, leading to Orndorff pinning Bagwell at 13:47, and pretty wonderful. Win the tag titles, and they note how Bagwell has now lost the tag titles with two partners at back-to-back Halloween Havocs. What a loser.
And he's had a lot of tag teams in his whole career. There wasn't a much reaction throughout the entire match, but there was a huge pop for the title change, which, I mean, you know, suggests that it's probably just very rare in those days.
Well, second longest match on the show. Maybe a little too long. Okerlund's backstage with Ric Flair and Sherry. And they announce that tonight it's all going to come to an end for Hulk Hogan. And then Flair says, What it all comes down to is my butt, your butt. It's all on the line.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all coming down to tonight.
The butts.
And Sherry's work here, she was almost like Damian Sandow. She just would repeat everything Flair said, but just yell it louder. I did enjoy these two together. They were just nuts together.
Yeah, Sherry was great, too, on the show.
Shivani and Heenan suggest that perhaps Ric Flair has bought off Mr. T, and Heenan nearly called Ric Flair a son of a bitch before catching himself and calling him a son of a gun. And then they showed us a history of the feud between the Sullivan brothers, Kevin and Dave, who would later lose his mind and go by the name Evad, which is Dave spelt backwards.
Amazing.
Dave Sullivan's gimmick at the time, not that different from what happened with Abyss when Hulk Hogan first came into TNA, where he was the ultimate Hulk Hogan mark and thought he was Hulk Hogan.
Mm.
Got a robe and boots from Hulk Hogan.
Started doing his moves.
And that was it. Unfortunately, this resulted in Dave Sullivan having to wrestle. And Kevin Sullivan comes out first, announced formerly from Daytona Beach, now seeks sanctuary from the Conch Republic.
What?
That is where you bill the Taskmaster from. Not hailing from, seeking sanctuary from. The Conch Republic.
Okay.
Great honeymoon spot. Dave comes out to the new hit single, I Want to Be a Hulkamaniac, off the Wretched Hulk Hogan Boot Band.
So awesome.
Album. One of the worst songs I've ever heard.
Oh, so great.
Forget wrestling in life. This was the cheesiest song ever. They explain that the boots Dave is wearing are the same boots that Hulk Hogan wore when he beat Andre the Giant just down the road at the Pontiac Silverdome. And Heenan cuts him off saying he doesn't want to talk about the past. That will never happen again. Definitely wouldn't happen in this particular company filling the Silverdome. Kevin grabs the bandana and stomps on Dave. Kevin goes to the top, but gets tossed off. We saw a rather sloppy clothesline, a big boot. And then Kevin is pleading with him and goes to put the bandana on, lures in Dave, and then sucker punches Dave. They fight on the floor. Dave gets thrown into the steel post and then rebounds off of the post, climbs into the ring. But Kevin is too slow and is counted out in 5 minutes and 16 seconds.
No reactions to any of the Hogan mannerisms that David tries to do. I'm not upset that this match didn't go longer.
Some would say it went too long. 5:16 was more than enough. Kevin Sullivan was a great character. Dave Sullivan was not, and Dave Sullivan was also a pretty terrible wrestler. And unfortunately, these two were made brothers, and we had to get a brother versus brother match.
Were they legit brothers?
No, they were not legit brothers at all. And I was seeking sanctuary from the memories of this particular match.
Oh, we got the wrap, though, which is...
We did get the wrap,
that's true. The only worthwhile thing about the match.
Who would have thought that the Bella Twins had a, like, infinitely better match at Hell in a Cell last Sunday than this family squabble at Halloween Havoc 94? Then they showed a video profiling the feud between Dustin Rhodes and Arn Anderson. And the story was Dustin Rhodes seeking out Arn Anderson as a partner to take care of the Stud Stable. Great name. Terry Funk, Bunkhouse Buck, and Colonel Parker.
I feel like I've seen Dustin Rhodes in almost every show.
This guy is the ever constant in 90s, 2000s, 2010s pro wrestling. Is that a term, the 2010s?
The 10s.
The 10s.
Yeah.
Goldust is just... He's put on everywhere. A WWF, WCW tape, odds are Dustin Rhodes has a spot.
Mm-hmm.
So he seeks out Arn Anderson, who delivers this awesome promo about how they might get hurt permanently, but they're going to put the hurting on their opponents as well. And it led to Arn turning on Dustin Rhodes at the Bash at the Beach show and attacking the arm of Dustin Rhodes to set up this singles match. Arn comes out with Colonel Parker and Ming versus Dustin Rhodes. They showed Thomas Hitman Hearns in the crowd. Horrible theme music for Dustin Rhodes, appropriately entitled The Natural. It was terrible. Rhodes focuses on the left arm of Arn, and Anderson just ducks. Rhodes flies over the top, and not just over the top rope, also over the steps that would lead up to the ring. So lot of distance that Dustin covered here. Then we see Dustin pull guard. And Arn simply adjusts and puts Dustin's neck under the bottom rope and catapults him up, breaking his guard. Another argument for a ring instead of a cage. I would totally do this to you if you pulled guard. I'd just snap you up, put your neck right up against the rope. You would not be able to hold on.
No, no.
This was a great spot. Rhodes comes back, but then Anderson catches him, goes to the DDT, but Rhodes holds onto the rope. Rhodes then pulls his knee pad down to signify business is about to begin and drops the knee, and it misses Anderson's arm, but Anderson still grabs his shoulder in pain. And then Rhodes kicks out of a fall and then just runs back and stacks Anderson for the win at 9:51, and then Anderson attacks him after the match. So it seemed very little settled here. And a bit of an awkward ending.
I thought it was just a quick roll-up, you know, out of nowhere. I actually liked the match. I thought, you know, both guys are very good. Arn in particular, I think.
I think Arn Anderson is great. His promos, his work, a very underrated performer when you look back at the 90s.
Exactly.
And 80s, for that matter.
Totally. And it, a lot of fun to watch him here when, you know, you could still argue he was in his physical prime, just like... Very good shape, very aggressive, believable style. Seems to put a lot into all of his offense. And, you know, I love that the big spot of the match is the exposed knee, you know. No steel chairs, no cinder blocks, just the threat of this exposed knee pad. And
this match could have used a hologram, though.
And it got a big reaction just for something so simple.
Yeah, one thing I think WWE could really use right now is an Arn Anderson kind of performer. That veteran that, yeah, he's never going to be your main event guy, but you can put out there with young guys like a Dustin Rhodes was in 94.
Or like a Fit Finlay was.
Exactly, how they utilize Finlay. I think a guy like that would be so helpful. Mm-hmm. Got some name recognition, put him on with younger guys, and help them work up to a level where they're working every night with someone so experienced and better than them.
Right.
I think that role could be... utilized, but there aren't that many guys out there that come to mind.
I mean, Christian is still sort of an active.
Yeah, he could fit into there. You know, even I think to grab some guys that, yeah, they can't do the year-long schedule, but to, hey, we're going to bring in this guy to work 3 weeks of house shows. And, you know, Lance Storm, for instance, he's going to work house shows for three weekends in a row with a younger guy on the roster.
I don't see them bringing back Lance Storm.
But I'm just...
Of all the people they could bring back.
Not necessarily to put in a televised role, but for a house show, if you're going to do a Western Canadian swing, sure, put him on.
Well, I assume right now they just have... They're so bloated right now with the... At least with people up and coming that they probably just can't justify, you know, making an extra spot for an older guy.
Right. I would argue, though, that you're going to, you know... This guy being called up from NXT versus this guy going on the road.
I agree.
You know, instead of putting Adrian Neville and Sami Zayn, which they've been doing at the house shows, how much more would a Sami Zayn get working with an older veteran?
Well, I think a guy like a Jericho is pretty much put in that spot.
Yeah,
pretty consistently.
That's true. Okerlund is with Hogan, Jimmy Hart, and Ed Leslie in the back, who is simply identified as the Big Brother, Ed Leslie, one of his many monikers. This dude, like, I never thought a guy could fuck up a promo by not even saying a word, but Ed Leslie, once again,
what did he do here?
Ceasing to amaze me. I want you to go back. You know what? We're going to fucking watch this promo in silence,
okay? Did he not want to do the interview and said, hey, give me a...
It better be quick. I want to talk about Ed Leslie, and I'm going to find this promo on the WWE Network...
It's going to take you a while.
No, it's not, because they do have markers, and this is the first time I'm going to applaud these markers.
Did they? Because not when I looked at it.
Oh, shit. Do they not have markers?
Not for some of the WCW shows, for a lot of the WWE shows.
So they only have markers for the WWE shows?
Well, I'm sure they're working on it, but they only have so much time.
I heard from somebody that there was a new button attached, but I don't know if that's accurate, because I don't see that here.
I mean, I am using it on a Mac.
Violence.
So.
Should there have been a sexual warning on this with Sensational Sherry in the main event? I mean, that was a lot of skin for 94.
Let's see. No markers.
No, for Christ's sake. Well, don't worry.
It's also up on Daily Motion.
Oh, is it? Yeah. That's also a lot. Dude, you say that. This is the exact reason why more people are going to watch it on fucking Daily Motion. Because if I just want to find something quick...
It's slow. I think my number one complaint about the network right now is just I wish they had an option for different buffering sizes. Because I don't need it in full quality like they have. And if it means a quicker...
Like, look how I'm fast-forwarding. If I... Okay. Yeah.
Oh,
I found it pretty damn quick.
You got lucky, yeah.
Now, let's watch Ed Leslie throughout this goddamn promo. Just watch this idiot. Watch what he does all promo long. These stupid lips, like he's trying to swallow something. He's grabbing his face like a fucking idiot. What's he doing? Like, what are you... What's in his head right now? What am I trying to convey? What's the message, Way?
He's just a follower of Hulk Hogan's and he's...
Gene telling him, knock it off. Let's watch more. More of Oscar nominee Ed Leslie for this great role.
I don't think he's that bad here. I don't think he's
Look
that bad.
At this guy.
He's not
Pose, that. Lips.
He's not that offensive. John, I still sense a hint of bitterness towards your Ed Leslie from your personal relationship with him. I don't think he's that bad here.
Let's just watch the rest of this here. Hulk Hogan, who... Man, was this a passe promo, watching in 2014.
It was
just yell.
It was your typical Hulk Hogan promo. Why don't you put some audio in?
Not on this computer.
Okay.
No audio.
Yeah, your typical Hulk Hogan promo. I think we've had enough.
All right. Well, that's it. I was just trying to convey. His facials in this promo were just the only thing I could pay attention to.
Well,
they were so distracting.
The idea, his motivation there was to try to imply a connection, like a support for Hulk Hogan as much as he can to set up the turn later.
There was a great... Well, we'll get to it later with Edward Leslie. So Hogan says that he cornered Mr. T earlier and says how Mr. T is still training, still saying his prayers, and taking his vitamins by the pump. I think would be accurate for a lot of guys on this particular show.
By the syringe.
And says he trusts Mr. T, but get this, he doesn't trust the cage structure. And once Mr. T is in there, Ric Flair sucking Mr. T in.
Okay.
What the hell does that mean? He trusts Mr. T, but not when he's in the cage and under the influence of Ric Flair. That would mean you do not trust this man, would be my assumption.
The cage, I don't know, transforms him. It was your typical Hulk Hogan promo, you know, just kind of full of high energy, obnoxious confidence. But what I loved was the moment they cut back, Heenan just says, I don't detect any confidence in Hulk Hogan's voice. I think he thinks he's going to lose.
Heenan was great at just shutting down Hogan.
Yeah.
It was very good. You know, you can look back at Hulk Hogan's promos and, yes, feeling tired. But at this point, Hogan was a big difference maker on pay-per-view for WWE. Bash at the Beach was their new high point when it came to pay-per-view buys. And this Havoc show fell just below that. So, I mean, two pay-per-views in for – well, you also had Fall Brawl the prior month. But for big singles matches with Hulk Hogan, both with Ric Flair – they did well.
And the guy was hired to play this character, to deliver this type of promo.
Yes. It wasn't until really, you know, late 95, 96, when you were starting to really see the numbers reflect that staleness to the character. Mm. But at this point, you were still riding a very hot hand with Hulk Hogan. And then, many people thought the successor to Hulk Hogan in pro wrestling, Steve Austin, challenging Hacksaw Jim Duggan for the United States Championship. I would have loved for there to have been a Twitter in 1994 when Steve Austin lost to Jim Duggan in 3 seconds the prior month at Fall Brawl when Ricky Steamboat had to vacate the U.S. title due to a back injury, legitimate injury, which would shelve Ricky Steamboat for 15 years until he came back. And they awarded the title to Steve Austin, but then Commissioner Nick Bockwinkel said, we have a challenger for you, and out came Jim Duggan and beat Austin in seconds, and this led to the rematch at Halloween Havoc. And match began with a...
Did you notice, like, the graphics they had on this show? Like, whenever
the... The witch coming across the screen?
I was wondering what that was.
Yeah, it was a witch on a broom.
It looked like a ghost Homer Simpson. This is just the cheapest oh, fuck, like the cheapest transitions that, like, for graphics. It was just like a...
It's Halloween way.
And then they had this floating head that looked just like a Homer Simpson float and dissolve through the screen to wipe off the name.
The best Halloween Havoc set, which I don't know how much it cost, but was the giant, like, alien gremlin that came out and had the big hands on this giant pumpkin and would shake it as they came out.
Like, I wonder where all that stuff is now.
Oh, God. I would buy a warehouse just on that pumpkin.
You would?
That was one of my favorite parts about the WCW, NWO, the second game, Revenge, was all the different sets.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can't fault WCW for at least coming up with these elaborate sets.
Yeah,
like,
sure.
You come out on, like a boardwalk for Bash at the Beach where there was sand that they had in and
yeah.
A whole beach scene. I thought they were really fun. I liked them.
Mm-hmm.
So this match, not a Steve Austin classic, not a Jim Duggan classic. There was an atomic drop that sent Austin to the floor. The audience really did get into this, though. The idea of Jim Duggan, the American Patriot, mm-hmm. defending the United States title. They really got into. I'm really learning that these patriotic angles are about as a sure thing in wrestling as anything. With Rusev and with Jim Duggan 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
If I started a promotion, absolutely. I would have a communist. I would have America constantly under attack in my promotion and the hero to come out.
Even in Canada, you would do that?
No, I'd base my promotion in the States.
Right, okay.
I don't know.
No, you can't make.
Well, no. Maybe I'd sign Kevin Steen and Tim Horton would defend Canada's will.
Wow.
Against the evil Russian.
Dunkin' Donut.
That would be his finisher.
Yeah. Starbucks.
Oh, the Boston cream crab.
Wow.
Oh, he looks glazed over. Oh, boy. What happened in this match? Austin got the advantage, came off the turnbuckle with some axe handles, goes for a third one, but gets caught with a clothesline in midair. And then Austin, for whatever reason, gets into Nick Patrick's face and then low blows Jim Duggan. And Nick Patrick admonishes Steve Austin. He was able to catch this low blow.
He got his hands all over Steve Austin.
He was not having any of this bullshit. And Austin then misses a headbutt off the top. Duggan makes a comeback. As Schiavone notes, just like the working class of America that doesn't give up, and then Heenan points out, most of the working class is poor and out of work, though. And Duggan goes for his three-point stance, and Austin reverses it by back body dropping Duggan over the top rope, which in 1994 constituted a disqualification at 8:04.
I couldn't believe that this was 1994, and they called that DQ, because... I certainly don't recall seeing that ever in the WWE matches.
This was a Mid-South deal, and then Bill Watts brought that back when he was booking, and then when he was removed, they kept it for a while.
It just seemed like, I don't know, we're only a couple years removed from, like, I mean, I'm sure ECW even, you know, a couple years from this point, FMW was doing, like, flaming tables and stuff, and all of a sudden, to hear a match called for over-the-top rope throw, it took me back a little.
It was a little dated, but I did understand the idea behind it was it gives you an alternate finish. It does create something for the heel to do something heinous, but by the time 1994 had hit, I don't think the audience really looked at this as a viable finish or a heel tactic.
I also, especially considering guys are throwing themselves over the top rope to dive on people. And you had Sherry here dive from the top of the cage. Anyway, that's something else. But
DQ finish.
DQ finish. Duggan seemed very limited in his abilities. And so you had basically Steve Austin here play, you know, the workhorse. It reminded me a lot of Dolph Ziggler, actually. And not just because of the blonde hair, but just because of the way he would bump all around his opponent to make it for a compelling match. I thought Austin was great, but you have to, you know, commend how much Duggan was over with this audience. So, you know, people just love this guy.
Oakland plugs the hotline and then brings out Sting, who is in a tuxedo and 1994 shades.
What?
Oh, this man just screamed early 90s this look and those sunglasses.
You know the rapper Riff Raff?
Yes.
He's bringing these back.
He says he's going to watch the main event from the crowd and see which wrestler will lead wrestling into the 90s. What a burial statement of yourself.
I guess. It was also 94.
Yeah, like, we were well into the 90s
now. October 94.
Yeah, who's going to lead wrestling into the 90s?
Yeah.
Great promo for, like, 89. And a bad promo for you to be cutting about pretty much slotting yourself below these guys.
I wonder who would you say led them into the 90s, if not Sting? WCW.
I mean, when I think of WCW in the 90s, I think...
Nash and Hall?
I think Hogan and Goldberg as the two key stars of the 90s.
Goldberg didn't come by until, like what? Like, he didn't hit his stride until, what, like, 97?
Well, who were the most important people in the 90s for the company? I would argue it was number one Goldberg and number two Hogan.
I suppose I agree with you. But, I mean, to bring company into the 90s in 97, I think...
Well, I mean, Sting was your guy from, you know, the early 90s portion pre-Hogan, but right. WCW was also not doing tremendously well, so I wouldn't say he was leading them. He was the default babyface at the top.
Maybe it was the guardian angel.
Listen, this match was something else. We saw a video. First of all, the idea of, okay, how can we get the Big Boss Man without calling him the Big Boss Man? Well, you know what? He's going to be the guardian angel.
What's another authority type of figure?
Like, that wouldn't even be in my top 10. Like, I know the guardian angels is a real thing, but if I was trying to think of an authority kind of figure that protects the people, the guardian angel would not be in my go-to vault of ideas.
There's so many things wrong with this idea. First of all, the name. There's nothing that's at all intimidating about the name, the guardian angel. There's nothing angelic either about Ray Traylor. Nothing about his look nor his wrestling style that screams angels. And the look that comes with this thing, Boss Man, okay, you had a cop's outfit, you know. Here...
Don't knock the beret.
A beret... And just when he's got the beret off, he just looks like a dude who just got off his couch in a plain black t-shirt and pants. It just doesn't... I get the idea. Just doesn't translate to TV. This is just a terrible, terrible gimmick.
There were a bunch of beatdowns on television, including Harley Race getting involved with his standing headbutt to the Guardian Angel. I loved watching Harley Race, especially when he was paired with Vader. I thought they had a great chemistry together when Vader was the big heel with the former NWA champion as this old, tough bastard that Harley Race was. That's all I can describe him as. The Guardian Angel and his entrance, accompanied by the Angels. This was just goofiness at its height. So he comes out. Angel... Do I have to call him the Guardian Angel?
I'll probably slip
and call him the Big Boss Man. Ray Traylor took Vader to the floor and sent him into the barricade, and then he starts going after the old man, Harley Race, and slams him in the ring and punches him. Then he scoop slams Vader and drops him on top of Harley Race for a big reaction. Could have broken Harley Race's ribs here. And then Vader comes out of the corner with these right jabs that were just... nailing Ray Traylor in the face. There was no pulling of these punches. And Vader, notorious for this. And then would come off the second turnbuckle into a power slam by the Guardian Angel. We saw the Guardian Angel with a headbutt off the top for a two count. Then Ray Traylor smashes him with this palm strike to the face and then clotheslines him over the top rope to the floor. No DQ.
I guess it's the difference between a clothesline and a throw.
Clothesline, to me, a pretty offensive maneuver, sending a guy over the top rope. I mean, versus a back body drop?
I think that these are probably the debates those commissions have, much like we debate, you know, 12 o'clock, 12 to 6 elbows, downward elbows.
The way this ended was peculiar. You saw Vader go for a clothesline in the ring, but it was like his arm gave out, and... he goes to hit him, but showed, like, no strength in delivering this clothesline, but Ray Traylor just collapses like he's been shot and is like out cold. Vader then hits a Vader bomb, gets a two count. He goes for another with Traylor getting his knees up. And then he lifts up Vader for a front slam, then a sidewalk slam, but then goes after Harley on the floor and vertical suplexes Harley Race into the ring. And then upon landing, Vader splashes Ray Traylor and pins him at 8:17. A very physical match and exceeded my expectations because these guys just beat the shit out of each other at times during this match.
Right, yeah.
I did not enjoy this.
No, for me, it was just like any other big plundering heavyweight brawl. I suppose, you know, Vader, it was a bit more entertaining to watch because he's a bit more unique and probably stiffer in terms of his in-ring style, but I don't know. It was just big guys.
Vader wins. Okerlund brings out Thomas Hitman Hearns. He says there is nothing else for Hogan or Flair to think about other than winning, and he notes he's in his hometown. Thank you, Mr. Hearns. Then they showed a video building up this tag match with this hilarious video of Dusty Rhodes showing up at some dingy bar to recruit the Nasty Boys for Fall Brawl. I think there's few segments you can put Dusty in that he cannot salvage, and this was one of them. And it led to this big attack in the locker room with Terry Funk and Bunkhouse Buck, along with Ming, beating up the Nasty Boys, including a topless Brian Knobs, which was the answer to why Knobs always wore a shirt, and then setting up a future revenge attack by the Nasty Boys. And this was our tag match. Bunkhouse Buck and Terry Funk against the Nasty Boys.
Bunk and Funk
against the Nasty Boys. Jerry Sags brought out a pumpkin, and Brian Knobs brought out Beavis and Butthead masks.
Whoa.
The match starts, and it's just a...
You sure they were masks?
What do you mean?
I'm sure it just wasn't their faces?
Oh, I guess.
They look just like Beavis and Butthead.
I guess, a little bit. I always looked at, if you took the face of Chris Lieben...
They look like their dads. Beavis and Butthead's dads.
Yeah, I guess there is that similarity. I always looked at Chris Lieben and Stefan Bonner as like real life Beavis and Buttheads. If you look at their face, look at the actual face and compare them.
Really? I don't know.
Like dye Chris Lieben's hair blonde, the short blonde hair, and grow out Stefan Bonner's hair.
Okay, I'm trying to picture it.
They just brawl all over the place. At one point, Jerry Sags like plants his ass right on Terry Funk's face.
This was gross.
This was disgusting.
It wasn't his ass. It was like his taint. This is like shoving his taint into Terry Funk's face, man.
The hardcore legend. Terry Funk goes to the floor and grabs a chair and proceeds to blast himself in the head about 10 times with this chair.
It was probably to wipe away the stench. You know, he needed a concussion to forget the trauma that he suffered from seeing Jerry Sags' taint.
He took this chair and started swinging it wildly. I thought he was going to attack Muhammad Ali with this chair. He turned around and Ali was there.
Oh, my God.
And was way too close for comfort.
Jeez.
This madman, Terry Funk. Bunkhouse Buck then trips Knobs from the floor. The heels get the advantage. Buck then loads up his glove, and Nick Patrick catches him. Ming then gets onto the apron and goes to deck Knobs, who ducks, and Ming takes out Funk. And this leads to Jerry Sags hitting Terry Funk with a pile driver onto a pumpkin and pinning. Knobs would pin Funk 7:57. If nothing else, a pile driver on a pumpkin.
It's a first.
Awesome.
Yeah, I've never seen that before.
It was more Jerry Sags and his taint eating the pumpkin.
Yeah, I'd say
but
so.
We understood. They should have shot it from the other angle. I think it would have been more impressive.
I think Jerry Sags' taint definitely...
tainted the match. Mm-hmm. Left you with a bad taste in your mouth. This match. Then we had an in-ring ceremony with Muhammad Ali to promote the Muhammad Ali Future Foundation, with a portion of tonight's proceeds going to this foundation. Heenan says if the show ended right now, this would be the greatest pay-per-view ever. And in the ring, they have Gene Okerlund with Muhammad Ali, Bill Shaw, and Eric Bischoff to present Ali with a check and a plaque. And then Shivani and Heenan set up the main event, and they make their picks. Stunningly, they are split. And then our special referee comes out, Mr. T, sporting not only a Detroit Tigers hat, but a Detroit Red Wings jacket. No announcement of who this man was, no music, and thus came out to a very flat reaction. Followed by Hogan and Flair, and then Mr. T did get introduced in the ring, to be fair, by Michael Buffer. And Mr. T proceeded to keep this Detroit Red Wings jacket on for the entire match with his spandex pants and went down in history.
I feel like in the 90s there were no rules about what you could wear.
This was the era of just men being wild with their fashion in pro wrestling.
Crazy, yes.
If I were to tell you off the top of your head, the worst special referee in history, is Mr. T number one or is Mr. T number two? I thought he was horrendous.
Well, I'm sure there'd been worse. I did have issue with his count, though.
It was so bad that the announcers had to bring up how horrible this was. I think it threw off the performers as well.
They were just like baby slaps, you know? Like, it was like he was afraid to get his hand hurt.
This was quite the in hindsight, this guy should have just been some enforcer at ringside or something. I don't know. Maybe you don't do the cage gimmick. Maybe you just have Mr. T.
He was transformed, John. Once he enters the cage,
that's
he's
true.
Transformed.
I don't know what Mr. T added to this show, to be honest. I don't know how much muscle there was behind Mr. T being in a pro wrestling environment in 1994. Shivani says it was WCW that finally brought these two together to end it on pay-per-view, this feud. Flair gets the heat after going after the injured left knee of Hogan. We cut to this extreme close-up in Sting's glasses to see the reflection of the match.
Ooh, oof. Nice.
Some cinematography from WCW. Hogan runs Flair into the cage like a lawn dart. Flair comes back, hits this delayed vertical suplex. Shivani is bringing up the 1975 plane crash that Flair was in, where he broke his back and which retired Johnny Valentine. Flair is constantly climbing the cage, and this forced Shivani to bring up the fact this makes no sense because the match cannot end by escaping the cage. But yet Flair kept doing this in the match and was really bad miscommunication, I felt.
I got the sense, I mean, he was trying to do it, you know, to just escape from the brutality of the match against Hulk Hogan. But yeah, he did it a lot.
Shivani explains that maybe Flair is luring Hogan to the top as Hogan comes up and then rams Flair's head into the steel bar. And I thought Flair's selling was really great throughout this. He was a great opponent who knew Hulk Hogan's limitations, sold big for all of his stuff. And I think Hulk Hogan throughout his career would look at Ric Flair as his best opponent to get the best possible match out of a Hulk Hogan match. Mr. T here with his dramatic pinfall counts. Shivani notes his three counts may not be polished and something that Hogan and Flair will have to adjust to. That would be true. He then has to cover for Flair once again climbing the cage. Flair goes back to attacking the knee. He's tearing off the knee wrap, and Heenan is just proclaiming how he hates Hogan, hopes he never hears from him again after tonight. Flair would get the figure four, and Mr. T was so confused here with Hogan's back down, not knowing if this was a pinfall or not, and just give the worst count, unsure if it's a pinning situation, and then Hogan turned it over. And then Hogan comes off the ropes, runs into Mr. T with a shoulder block, and out goes Mr. T, somewhat defeating the very purpose of having this enforcer referee in the cage. And then Flair starts stomping on Mr. T, who would then be out for approximately 15 minutes. This leads to Sherry climbing the cage, but Jimmy Hart pulls her down and tears off her skirt way. And then she drops Jimmy, goes back. Sting then tries to grab Sherry down, and the masked man comes out from under the ring and attacks Sting and Jimmy Hart, leading to Sherry climbing to the top of the cage, diving off the top of the cage to Hogan's back, and he no-sells this. I don't care what you are, coming off the top rope like that.
Yeah,
and Hogan just stands there after the woman just dove off the top of a cage.
I was very surprised that they gave Sherry so much offense. I mean, I would understand if it was like a wrestler, but I mean, Sherry is supposed to be a valet, and here she was being positioned as like Jimmy Snuka, diving off the cage and then like basically working, you know, the last half of the match on par with Ric Flair.
Flair then clips the knee of Hogan. They handcuff Mr. T to the rope and then run Hulk Hogan into a steel pipe. Hogan hulks up after this and scoop slams both Flair and Sherry. He's delivering clotheslines to them, big boots to both, then hits the leg drop to Ric Flair right in front of Mr. T, who's still handcuffed, and Mr. T counts three at 19 minutes and 26 seconds. They really had the crowd behind Hogan here with his comeback, and I think a lot of that you can attribute to Flair and Sherry being great as heels. Hogan is then celebrating, and a masked man comes up from behind to attack Hogan, but Hogan catches him, grabs him in the ropes, and it's revealed as Brother Brutai, who is begging off of Hogan.
No.
Until Kevin Sullivan and the debuting Avalanche, John Tenta, storm the ring and beat down Hogan. And it appeared that Schiavone got on the loudspeaker in the ring, in the arena, to identify who the masked man was, repeating, "That's Brother Brutai," almost as if the crowd didn't react to Ed Leslie as the next top heel. And the reaction was, "Oh, they can't tell it's Ed Leslie. This is a huge deal." So they repeat that. Sting returns for the save. Hogan is selling big. And it ends up with Hogan left laying and a lot of heat put on John Tenta and Ed Leslie. And as they replay, Bobby Heenan describes Sherry as being graphically disrobed during the match. And Heenan is basically in tears, describing Ric Flair's career being over, which was really an afterthought after this angle afterwards, and being done, and loses his composure as they go off the air with Ric Flair's final match ever until he would return in March of the following year.
I thought up until the interference, I thought the match was surprisingly good.
Oh, very good.
You know, I thought Hogan and Flair here hit their cues perfectly. Flair, of course, is great. And I thought Hogan, for what he was there to do, did everything that you would expect him to do very well. And the crowd, I thought the anticipation for this match was really high, with a lot of fanfare, and the crowd definitely, you know, played their part too. I didn't even mind the interference all that much. I found it all kind of like campy and entertaining, though the fact that they just allowed a finish even after all that was a little silly, especially in a cage match.
Yes. Coming out of this show, they did an interview with Ed Leslie where this never did end up making it to air, but the original explanation was that Hulk Hogan was so busy filming a movie that when Ed Leslie's, one of his parents died, Hulk Hogan didn't show up on time for the funeral.
Oh, wow.
Before they scrapped this idea and just kind of decided,
yeah,
that's not enough of a motivation
okay.
for Ed Leslie to turn on Hulk Hogan, which would lead to the main event of Starrcade.
Show up on time.
On time. Not that he didn't show up. He didn't show up on time.
Yeah. It's a little dark, too, I'd say, for this era.
I think they realized that and decided not to go that direction. But nonetheless, this was... I wanted to read this line from the Wrestling Observer from October 24th of 1994. So this would have been going into Halloween Havoc. Flair is insisting that even though this decision was against his wishes, he's not going to be one of these wrestlers who keeps making comebacks, and that Sunday really is going to be his final appearance and to expect a classic match in his finale. For years, Flair has said that he'd walk away from wrestling, at least as far as being an active competitor, the day he could no longer be Ric Flair, i.e. be a headliner. As mentioned 2 weeks back, if he were to make a comeback after a year of inactivity, at best he'd be in the Randy Savage position, and he appears to strongly not want to be considered as a guy who once was a great while still active. In wrestling, all decisions are subject to change, and the odds are great that WCW will fall into a bind next year and want to bring him back, and an awful lot of people are believing by that time Flair will change his mind.
Oh, that's great foresight.
That was tremendous foresight. Yeah. And Ric Flair, 20 years later, I still don't believe he's had his last match.
You know, anytime I'm sure somebody, you know, wants to retire, I don't doubt that that's probably what's going on through their mind at that time. But I imagine you can only sit at home for so long and not be bored. So I'm sure he's given up on that. And Flair would come back tomorrow if he could.
There was also the sense at this time amongst a lot of fans that, you know, with Hogan coming in and bringing in so many guys associated with the WWF, that it was too much.
Yeah.
You know, when you were talking, it's one thing when Savage followed him in, but now we're talking Earthquake, Brutus. Even to a lesser extent, Jim Duggan, Honky Tonk Man. It's like you can pick a few guys, but when it's starting to overtake everything and they're coming in, I mean, it just was starting, okay, it's very much not an alternative here. We're trying to take characters from Hogan's past that worked well with him or even didn't work well with him and really turning WCW into a very WWF-light product. And I think there was too much of those guys coming in and not enough emphasis on your own.
Definitely. I mean, you know, you have a guy like Steve Austin here. He had a good spot, but I mean,
even Sting really phased down.
Yeah. But, you know, I think the show for 1994 really just played more like a shitty version of like an 80s WWF show.
Felt like that to people. A main event I did enjoy. I thought it was a pretty, you know, put your standards at where you expect a Hulk Hogan match to be in 94.
Was good.
Crowd was really into it. Yeah. So the main event I thought did deliver. And the pay-per-view largely did pretty well from a purchasing standpoint. So I give this show a 6 out of 10.
Yeah, mainly for the main event, I'd probably give it a 6.5.
We will now hear from Dan the Mouth Lavransky, who in October of 1994 set out on a road trip to go watch Ric Flair's last match of all time for 5 months.
Whoa, he was there?
He was there.
Wow.
He was there for the greatest pay-per-view of all time, pre-main event. And let's find out what he had to say after the main event of this classic, according to Bobby Heenan. All right, we have tracked down one of the patrons who made their way to the Joe Louis Arena on the night of October 23rd, 1994, an event I had no clue this man attended. Dan the Mouth Lavransky with us. And Mouth, I mean, it's been 20 years since Ric Flair retired. Amazing how time flies.
You know what was so funny, John? It's the same kind of thing as like what we talked about when we did the Starrcade 95 review a couple weeks ago. And the WWF was in just such a boring state at this point. And me and my friends were so into Ric Flair and stuff. And we knew this was not going to be a proper retirement. We thought, it's ridiculous. Why should Ric Flair retire? If anyone should retire, we were thinking it should be Hogan retiring at this point. So we knew that he wasn't going to be gone for long. But that was actually the reason I managed to convince my buddies. I was like, come on, it's going to be his last match, which none of us really believe, though.
Now, had you started, were you getting the Observer at this point? Because going back and looking at this, I mean, Dave was as skeptical as you were that this was the end of Ric Flair, but it seemed that at this time, whether it was Ric Flair playing hardball with WCW, I mean, he wasn't interested in this stipulation, but said, if we go through with it, that's it. I'm done.
Yeah, well, I you know what? I have to think with the power of hindsight that he must have just been talking to try to get the angle over, because it was within 2 or 3 months he was back again. Like, I mean, there was even any real attempt to make it look like he was retiring. He came back pretty quickly.
No, I mean, and that was noticeable after the match, which I thought was a pretty good main event per, you know, Hulk Hogan standards at the time. But then he was immediately rushing to the next program, which was Ed Leslie and John Tenta as the new heel adversaries for Hulk Hogan. And it was almost like as soon as Ric Flair was just an afterthought during all the post-match.
You know what I think it was, John, and again, I don't have anything to back it up. This is just my own feeling with hindsight. But if you look at this show and see who was on it, this was really when Bischoff was really just wanted to get everybody from WWF, and they were just like anybody. Like, look who's on this show: Honky Tonk Man, Hacksaw Jim Duggan, the Big Boss Man as the Guardian Angel. Like, and I think that's part of it, John. You know, getting Brutus Beefcake. Earthquake, who, you know, I really think that they were so obsessed with kind of making the product or getting all the guys that Vince had created and were already stars that they didn't even care about Ric Flair because they, I think maybe they just felt he'd been around too long. Remember, this is the time when they were really trying to get him to retire because they thought he wouldn't draw anymore. And then we saw there at Starrcade a year later, they put the title back on him. So I think at this point, because this is Hogan coming in and Hogan calling all his buddies to come, I think that was a big part of their focus, and they didn't really care about Flair.
And it was really a curious decision because they were coming off that Bash at the Beach debut with Hogan, which did their all-time highest amount of buys on pay-per-view with Ric Flair, and then came back, did a pretty good number for this Havoc show, and I'm sure a lot of it was on the shoulders of Hogan, at least internally, but you really didn't have somebody to just step in and replace Ric Flair. Like, Vader wasn't necessarily your next guy after this. They were going to Ed Leslie. That pay-per-view bombed with those two on top.
Yes.
And
yes.
It was the pattern of, well, we need to go back to Flair, and yeah, he was back by March of the next year.
Yeah, exactly. It was just one of those things where they had in their head that, you know, Ric Flair, he's just too old now. Whether he could perform or not, it's ridiculous because, I mean, he could still work in the ring better than a lot of guys and he could still cut great promos. But I just think the WCW management at that time, they just thought that he was a liability. They just thought that's it, that car's out of gas. There's nothing left in the tank. But, you know, as we've proven, even in 2014, you can bring Ric Flair out and get a pop.
Now, as someone that was watching WCW week in and week out with the influx of Hulk Hogan, and you mentioned a lot of the names that were being brought in at this time, what did you feel? Because I kind of compared it to what we saw a couple of years back with TNA when Hogan and Bischoff came in, and suddenly it became anyone that was a star in the Attitude Era or in the WWE, they brought in, and it really kind of took away anything TNA had built up. And we were seeing this in WCW at the time with Sting being phased down, with Steve Austin being phased out, and in favor of a lot of talent from yesteryear at this point.
No, you know what? I think you're absolutely right, John. I mean, look at this match. Hacksaw Jim Duggan against Steve Austin. It's almost practically a jobber match. And in fact, if I remember correctly, this was pretty well the end for Austin. He was, after this, I don't know if he even was on, I'm not even sure he was on another pay-per-view after this. And they just jobbed him out constantly after this. Like, you know, and then, that, like, but look, there's Mr. Wonderful, and there's, you know, Sensational Sherry, and there's, you know, like, there was hardly any of their regular guys, really, when you look at this card, you know? It's crazy. I really think that they thought, well, if we can just get all the old guys that Vince has made stars out of, we can keep going. Not realizing that a lot of those guys, and I mean a lot of them, like Piper and that, they were totally on their last legs in terms of performing in the ring at this point.
Now, do you have any memories looking at the card here? Anything that stands out for you that you recall going back 20 years here? Any fond memories of Dave Sullivan and Kevin Sullivan?
Oh, Jesus, John. I knew you were going to bring that up. That was the freaking worst. It's got to be one of the worst angles I've ever seen in my life. I hated that program with a passion. It was so stupid. They brought him in as kind of the ultimate Hulkamaniac fan at first, and they acted like he was mentally challenged. It was just a really stupid angle, a real waste of someone like Kevin Sullivan as well. Like, what are you doing putting this guy in here that can cut great promos, pretty smart guy, and you're just doing this silly angle with his supposed brother? I thought that was really bad. And I remember Honky Tonk Man's match with Johnny B. Bad was atrocious. I remember it went to a draw and they did jack shit. They just, like, you know, chin locks, and like, it was the most boring match with a time limit I'd ever seen in my life. There was no drama, no build, nothing. You know, so a lot of this show was not the better show. I think we were more just interested in driving to Detroit and going on a road trip for a lot of this.
One of the pairings I really did enjoy at this time was Big Van Vader with Harley Race. I thought the two just complemented each other so well. Harley was still getting physical at this point with headbutts.
Well, look at the poor bump he has to take in this match where the boss man, the angel drops boss man right on, or drops Vader right on top of Harley.
Scoop slams Vader to drop on Harley Race. Like, we couldn't have done this vice versa, you think? Like, with Harley with a big cushion underneath. No, we're going to dump Vader onto Race.
Yeah. And if you look at the boss man there, he's having a hell of a time getting Vader up. Like, he's not, that was not one of your more confident slams right there. I was not a big fan of the Guardian Angel gimmick, John. I think I really liked Big Boss Man a lot, and I just really thought the Guardian, it was very topical at the time. It was in the news a lot at that time in New York City with the Guardian Angels guarding the subway and stuff like that. And I think they were trying to cash in on that, but I didn't really like him in that persona. I thought he was better playing a heel.
As you and your friends kind of left that night, I mean, what was your impression of the show at the time? I mean, did it over deliver? Were you disappointed? What do you recall from that night?
I don't remember being really disappointed or thinking it was really great. I think we all had a good time because we're gonna have fun no matter what. I mean, you know, a show where one of the Nasty Boys does a pile driver on a pumpkin can't be all bad.
Terry Funk, one of his ultimate bumps that he took, a pile driver.
Unbelievable Terry Funk, the stuff he's done. But I think we enjoyed, like, it was the reason we would go to a lot of these shows is it was always fun to go to them live. You always had fun with the people in the crowd, and you knew you were going to see some crazy stuff when you went to a WCW show. So I don't really think we felt it was either super fantastic or uncontrollably bad. I think we just thought it was a pretty average show, and we had a good time. And I think, I remember as we were leaving, we were talking about how long would it be before we'd see Flair again.
As I'm sure many were. And it was,
yeah,
this,
that was the big...
Was this just in and out in Detroit? Did you guys go there for the weekend? Were there any highlights of Detroit?
Yes, no, we did. We did go to for the weekend. There was... We went the day before on the Saturday because at the time in Windsor, which is close to the border in Detroit where you cross to go to Joe Louis, there was a new casino opening at the time. So we also went on Saturday to have some fun at the casino. So there you go. That was our weekend, gambling and wrestling.
Well, I know our final question, for the benefit of Jason Agnew, is what identification you use to get into the United States?
Yeah, that's right, because this is before that. Jeez, I must have had something, John, or they didn't bother us. That was one of those times when I don't remember them saying anything at the border except, what are you doing? And the thing is, where we crossed was very close to Joe Louis Arena, so the guards all knew about the show and stuff like that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I remember that they knew, and when we said we were going to see Halloween Havoc at Joe Louis Arena, they knew what we were talking about.
Maybe they were a border patrol and freelanced as Guardian Angels, perhaps, and they were very much...
You see, exactly. They could very well have had the red caps right there in their bags, and I didn't even see it.
Well, Mouth, I want to just thank you for quickly taking us back. I had no idea you attended this show till you told me on Sunday on the
lawn. Well, it was just back at that time, John, because WCW didn't come to Toronto a lot, but they'd love to do pay-per-view events in Buffalo, Detroit, places that we could get to, and it was just so much fun. And the WWF product, we were also stale on it at that point. They had nothing going on at the moment, and I think it was partially because they would do these shows close that we could get to, and also because, you know, it was always fun to see Ric Flair live, and Arn Anderson too, right? They had done the big angle leading into this pay-per-view where Arn was all dressed in black and took Hogan out at the Clash of the Champions, so we all, you know, I'm sure you saw the clip, even though Arn's wearing completely black and has a mask on, you can instantly tell that it's Arn Anderson by the way the guy moves. But I think it was the thrill of seeing guys like Arn and Flair and those guys, Orndorff, seeing some of those guys in person and just being kind of bored with the WWF product. So it was a good way to spend a weekend.
But not enough to go down to Nashville for Starrcade for Hogan and Ed Leslie.
No, I think it was back to the bar to watch. Although I'm not even sure. I'm pretty sure I probably saw it at the time, but that was the time too when, you could still kind of go to bars to watch pay-per-views, but for WCW, it was always really hard, and I always ended up in like some of the most diviest bars here in Toronto just to be able to watch WCW pay-per-view. In fact, I remember winning a bet with some idiot that was, stupid enough to bet with me on a wrestling match in a bar once.
Was this for a live match, or was this had it already
been
taped?
It was a pay-per-view match. It involved I can't remember what show it was, John, but I remember the match was Sting against Luger, and this guy was confident that Sting was going to win, and I had already heard, whether it was through the newsletter or read somewhere, that Sting was, this was it for Sting for a while. He was going to take a break. He was just taking a break and going to rest or whatever. So the guy wanted to bet me. I'm like, are you sure? He goes, yeah, man, I'll bet you $20. Sting's going to win. I'm like, okay, man, if you say so. So, you know, we get to the main event, and sure enough, Sting loses, and the guy was all disgusted, but he paid me the $20, so that's all I cared about.
Can't fault him. That's almost like insider trading, though, to be fair.
Yeah, but come on. Okay, fair enough, but by the same token, John, anyone stupid enough to bet on a pro wrestling match deserves to have their money taken.
Well, it's a great story nonetheless. Well, Mo, thank you for helping us shut the door on Halloween Havoc 1994, and of course, Mouth will be back this Sunday night on The Law with myself and Jason Agnew, and we've got Chris Jericho on the show this weekend. And
looking forward to that. It's always great when we have Jericho on the show. He's always so entertaining. So, and have you finished the book?
I have finished the book. Yes, another great book from Chris Jericho. There's a lot of wrestlers out there who they'll have entertaining stories, but not always the greatest writers. I think Jericho, he's a tremendous writer. I think Mick Foley falls into that category. Guys that could write non-wrestling stuff, and I think it would be interesting as well. He's just
I'm sure, you know, if he's smart, he should do one about his Fozzie experiences and stuff like that, right? I'm sure he could do one about, you know, years in a metal band or whatever. That'd probably have some good stories in it.
All right. Well, thanks as always, Mouth. We appreciate the time.
Okay, man. Take care, John.
All right. So those were Dan Lavransky's thoughts, some live memories of Halloween Havoc 1994.
20 years ago.
Would you have gone to this show?
Hey, Dan would have been our age. Isn't that crazy?
We should go on a road trip to see Ric Flair's next retirement match.
See his retirement
match. Maybe it'll be in Detroit. Have it at the Joe Louis Arena.
I'm there. That's incredible to think of Dan like as our age.
As being 30?
30, yeah.
I guess, yeah, it would have been about that age.
Crazy.
We'll now go to the Law message board, which you can sign up for free, lawradio.proboards.com, and we start off with McWhalen. This is the very definition of a one-match show. Hogan and Flair was a great little match, if not overbooked, and maybe Hogan's best match since leaving the WWE in 93. Hogan's friends were all over the card, and there was not a great match on the undercard. I give Halloween Havoc a 4 out of 10. Watch Flair and Hogan, but the rest is skippable.
We go to Chris in Ottawa. Happy Halloween, gentlemen. Forget new original content, pre-show, post-show, all of it. I subscribe to the WWE Network for the incredible depth of the company's tape library, and Halloween Havoc 94 is a perfect example. And when the Anthem singer showed up wearing that insane shirt that was two sizes too big, and Johnny B. Badd wore dollar store fangs to the ring, I knew we were in for a real treat. Kicking off a pay-per-view with a 10-minute Broadway was genius. Making Hulk Hogan, the biggest star in wrestling history, play an Nancy Kerrigan in a knee-clubbing angle, and having Mean Gene tell the fans that the Hulkster is so tough that he walked a whole two blocks from the hospital to the arena to face Ric Flair was another triumph. But aren't we lucky that WCW's crack production staff didn't edit out the sign during the Hogan recap angle to let us know that Hulk is actually an acronym that stands for humanity, understanding, love,
oh,
and
it
kindness.
Was love.
And then Hogan goes out and maybe has the best match of his run down south. But the highlight for me was Paul Roma hitting a great-looking elbow during the worst perfect plex ever recorded to win the tag belt.
Oh.
I was always a big Paul Roma fan when I was a boy. Great athlete, that power and glory finish, although I understand he was difficult to do business with. And throughout all of it, multiple photographers would partially obstruct the hard camera by standing on the near side of the ring throughout the show. 10 out of 10 from WCW.
Wow. Some high praise for Halloween Havoc. Matt, in suburban Detroit, I was there for this Halloween Havoc. Wish I would have waited a year to see a better one. The better one, let's recall, was Paul White falling off of a building and coming back moments later. WWF Jr. was in full effect on this pay-per-view. Bagwell and another tag team? Where was Too Cold Scorpio to make Buff look good? At least Paul, too, pulled off Paul Squared, I guess, Orndorff and Roma, pulled off a solid Midnight Express finish. Evad versus Kevin Sullivan, smack my head. Obvious best match was Double A versus Gold Dustin Seven Reigns. Dustin should have never had to do a ridiculous gimmick like Cody's forced to do now. 2 out of 10, and that's one for Arn and one for Rhodes.
Randy in Australia. I sat down to watch this on a Saturday morning. I had fallen asleep by the end of the second match following the inspired decision to open up the show with a time limit draw. I started watching again on Saturday afternoon. I shouldn't have restarted the second match. After all, it put me to sleep the first time. I got through this shit best the second time, though.
Another great name for a WWE pay-per-view. That should have been one they do every year.
And even got through the horrific Sullivan rubbish. But there must have been a big break before Arn versus Rhodes, because I fell asleep a second time before that match even started. But the third time I started watching, it was late on a Saturday night, and I knew what I was about to put myself through. So during this attempt to watch the show, I spent some time working on Chronic's gimmick years before they ever existed. And on my third
drugs got him through this show.
And on my third attempt to watch, I saw close to the worst Steve Austin match I've ever seen. I saw Vader, who was the only good thing on the show. But when I fell asleep for a third time watching the Nasty Boys stink the joint up, I had to tap out. Sure, my third sleep was only partially WCW's fault, but I couldn't do it a fourth time. I'm sorry, it's an incomplete review.
No, I enjoy those reviews. DC here. This was a weak pay-per-view other than the Vader Bossman match. To me, this was the best match on the card. One of the better matches I have seen with two big men. When people discuss athletic big men, you usually hear names like Vader and Bam Bam, but I always forget how quick and agile the Big Boss Man was. He really showed it during his match against Vader, especially with his quick strikes in the opening part of the match. I also forgot how great of a seller Boss Man was. He slightly exaggerates, but isn't on the level of Dolph, Mr. Perfect, or Seth Rollins. But he made sure that he let the fans know what body part was affected by the wrestler on offense. I give this pay-per-view 3 out of 10.
All right, our next piece of feedback, he says, I ordered this pay-per-view back in the day. I remember Hacksaw and Steve Austin being in a feud for the U.S. title at the time. I've heard several interviews recently where Duggan talks about the beef he has with Austin because Steve didn't want a job to him. I guess Austin wasn't a fan of Hogan's heroes coming to WCW and taking all the top spots. On to the main event, great drama between Ric Flair and Hulk Hogan, but to me the biggest star was Sensational Sherri. I remember in the WWF the Hulkster would always give her an atomic drop exposing her lingerie to the audience, but here we got the full Monty thanks to Jimmy Hart. Was very surprising to see Hogan actually beating up Sherri with clothesline slams and even a big boot. When I watched live, I thought he would just give her an atomic drop as always. I found it funny that he did all his other moves on her except the atomic drop, which he was known to do. Not a great match, but great drama, even with the reveal of the masked man at the end.
Ronaldo from Milan, Italy. Mostly I remember this pay-per-view because back in 1994, I was an avid Aftermag reader, and they would focus 70% of their work on WCW, and the Hogan-Flair feud looked like the holy grail for indie wrestling magazines. One thing is that if the WWF was at fault for not promoting a huge Hogan versus Flair match at WrestleMania, WCW drove it to the ground. To the point, I really didn't care about this retirement match. It was good, undercard was good, but really nothing WCW could write home about as far as promotion could get. WWF still had the best matches and characters, and WCW had just burnt one of their many dream matches they could have developed into further earnings.
Our final piece of feedback. As someone who didn't watch this when it originally aired, it's kind of strange to look at how this main event was set up in Hogan's favor. A pro-Hogan town with a Hulkster crony as a special guest referee. I can imagine that the true and blue WCW fans from this era had a feeling of dread going into this pay-per-view, and everything was spelled out specifically for Hogan to go over. However, my favorite part of this show is the backstage story Flair talked about in his book. He had such a huge distrust for Eric Bischoff and the shift in Turner management that he felt that the entire retirement angle was a way to write him off. Flair's contract would have ended in the same time period. He would have been a way to sell the loss to Hogan and basically wouldn't go through with the match until he had a guaranteed extension for extra protection against losing his job for real. No rating, as I couldn't find the time to watch the entire thing, but I love hearing you guys go over these shows.
Yeah, and that's accurate. And he got that extension through 97, I believe, going into that. So that was Halloween Havoc, 1994. What an interesting review. And Way, next week.
Actually, that would have been... Oh, never mind. I was going to say. I was thinking about, like, that would have been the baseball strike. So, no World Series that year.
That's true. Yeah, you're right. The year that Expos fans, they've just... 1994 never existed.
Their phantom win. They just some championship.
Some just accept they won the World Series in 94.
Yeah, sure.
If you want to believe that. Yeah. I mean, we go on strike halfway through the season. Yeah, nothing would have happened differently the second half. I'm going to get some angry messages from people. The fact is, they probably would have collapsed. Next week, though, this show is not going to collapse. is going to rise. It is going to go and take a look at the Monday Night War, the new, and I use this term loosely, documentary series profiling some of the high and low points of the six-year battle between the WWF and WCW on Monday nights. And Wei, you have selected two episodes to review next week as we take a look at the Monday Night War.
Yeah, I assume, I mean, I haven't seen any of these Monday Night Wars little specials. They're about an hour long each, but I assume a lot of the content is probably things that we've already kind of discussed a lot or have seen a lot. But so I chose two of them that we haven't really discussed so much. And the first one I was curious about watching was the Cruiserweights.
The Flight of the Cruiserweights.
Flight of the Cruiserweights that recently aired probably like 2 weeks ago.
Yes.
And one that is about to air, or sorry, did air.
Premiered last night.
On Monday, about Chris Jericho. Yeah, watch those two. Leave some feedback, or just leave some feedback in general to the series.
Yes, so you can watch both episodes on the WWE Network. And, of course, speaking of Chris Jericho, he will be our guest on The Law this Sunday night, midnight Eastern time, with myself chatting with Chris Jericho about his new book. And I'm sure there's many, many topics we will dive into. So that is going to wrap things up for this week. Do go on over to liveaudiowrestling.com if you want to catch our Hell in a Cell review from The Law Sunday night. Review a Raw discussing that show on Monday from Austin, Texas. Are you recovered?
What a show. Jeez.
Are you back to normal now?
Man, I'm still shaking.
You gotta, still got the shakes. You gotta watch it sometimes.
I know.
You had some people worried. Yeah. So that is going to be the finale. The finality? The final discussion of the day. I'm so tired right now. What do you want to go out with? Some songs. Right?
Oh, come on. Can we go out with any other song but the Hulk Hogan rap?
Oh, sure. Here it is. Dave Sullivan's entrance theme, which had a worldwide release at the 1994 Halloween Havoc, I Want to Be a Hulkamaniac, featuring MCH2.
Education each and every day. These are all the things that the maniac says.